Session number 5868, Horton Monday, part 52.
He'd get a medal of some sort for capturing a prisoner. And often, very, very often, it was someone that had got a friend in the regiment or close to it, sergeant major or someone, that may have been his uncle. Those are the sort of people, then he'd get a medal. Now, all those chaps that went with him, they didn't get anything. It was only him that got it. Another occasion, the same party'd go out another night, perhaps, and lose two or three men and get back no prisoner at all. Well, there was no medals for any of them at that time then. Well, there's a difference. That one had a medal, others had nothing. Now, let me wander on perhaps from that. Shall we talk about why I think people was treated as cowards, say? Well, now there were so many instances where you could be had for cowardice, which they call cowardice. But in the first place, you must remember that the old discipline stood in those days, the old discipline from the Boer War and so forth. If you done the slightest thing that was not according to the routine, military routine, you was termed, well, should I say, a coward on active service. Well, that could easily be come about by when you got in the line, especially the first time, where you left England, you was full of beans, you wanted to see the war, you wanted to get to it, you volunteered for it, and you wanted to get into it. Well, once you got in those trenches, and you had a battering of shell fire, machine gun and shell fire, you altered your tune a little bit then. You realised what war was like. Now, nerves, it's nerves, not cowardice. Some had more better nerves than others, some had very poor nerves. Now, if you was caught during one of those shelling, heavy shelling, and that always preceded a battle, heavy shelling, and once they started heavy shelling, you had to get on what they call the fire step, or line the fire step in case they broke across. Now, if you was in, officer would come along while the shelling was on and see that, you know, you was all at your post. Now, if he found someone sulking in a dugout at the back, see, you had dugouts at the back of your trench where you used to go in, get a sleep, and that when you was all, when your turn was off. And if you was caught sulking in there and the officer came in and told you to get out and your nerves had gone and you wouldn't come out and he reported it, it was 1,000 to 1, because you had a court-martial naturally, and it was 1,000 to 1 you had to face a firing squad in those days, because there were so many sent back, and it happened, people getting sentenced to death facing a firing squad for simple things. Just that was one instance I quoted. And anyone found behind the line, wandering behind the line, after a shelling or anything, and they'd wandered back and was found 2 or 3 days later, that was another certainty of a firing squad. Well, that got back into the papers in Britain. This I'm talking about early, beginning of 1915. That got back into the newspapers, and it caused outcry, because when anyone was sentenced, court-martialed, sentenced, shot, the parents or next of kin had a lovely letter from the colonel. He died fighting for his country. That was the letters they got. Not that they'd been shot at a court-martial for cowardice. Oh, no. Well, now, following that, the outcry in England, they began to realise the different things that was happening, and it wasn't cowardice. It was nerves gone. And they termed it then, they were sent home with what they called shell shock. Now, shell shock, it was shell shock, breakdown of nerves. But, because that was fiddled a lot then after that, and that's what you might imagine in chaps had shell shock and so on, or tried it then, but they didn't get away with it very, very often. Now, all those ambulance coaches, they was built at Wolverton, regular, full-time working building ambulance coaches, and every ambulance coach had a padded cell fitted to it. And I know this is right, because when I came back out of the army, I was a bodymaker, and we was employed the whole of the time stripping these ambulance coaches out, and that all got padded cells in. We stripped them out and turned them into brake vans. Right. Now then, where shall we go from there? I told you a bit about cowardice.
There were other examples of cowardice, weren't there, on in terms of sentry duty. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, yes, yes. Well, that is sort of sentry duty. And then there's another point in sentry duty that you got had for. This is early on, mind you. If you stood in the night, you see, you had 2 hours on, 4 hours off. And those 2 hours, you see, you stood on the fire step, say, or you're supposed to. See, your fire step was about a foot or 18 inches from the bottom of the trench, so that when you stood on that, then you could see over your sandbags and the parapet to fire from. Well, when you was on duty, in the night, you were supposed to stand on that fire step for your 2 hours. Now, the ones that you relieved, that relieved you, the 4 hours off, when you'd had your 2 hours, those that was off was either back in the dugout or sat down beside you on the fire step if it was a nice night. But you had to watch for that. Now, in the night, it's a hell of a job to keep awake, especially between 12 and 2. They're about the worst hours. And you were supposed to keep awake. You were supposed to watch across all the time. But if you once sat down in the night, it's 1,000 to 1 you fell asleep. You couldn't help it. But if you was caught there asleep, an officer used to wander along at the night, perhaps once in the night. If he wandered along, and he was one of the snotty-nosed type, a young one perhaps, wanted to make a name, and you was fast asleep on the fire step instead of standing up, he could take your rifle, because you always used to put your sling over your shoulder if you sat down to make sure. But if you was fast asleep and tired out after a few days in the line, he could lift that rifle off your shoulder. He could take it back to the senior officer's dugout and give it him and say, "Here's a man's rifle and he's fast asleep at his post." And it's 1,000,000 to 1. There's another case where you've had it. See, simple things like that. Now then, I'll wander off now. I'll tell you. Susie, want me to tell you tales? Mm-hmm. I'll wander off and tell you another tale. That was a brattle chap. I won't tell you his name because he'll laugh like hell if he's alive. Boy, do it if he is now. And we had a machine gun in the trench there. And now, in the nowadays, you have a machine gun each almost, but we only had one to the battalion. And this chap was cleaning his gun. It was one Sunday morning. He was cleaning it out and took it all apart. You know, it was one of them old Maxim guns on tripods. You'll see them in the museum. You won't, they're not used now. And that was an old Maxim gun. And he stripped it all out. You had a strip mate every so often, oil them, clean them, put them back. And then the ammunition used to run on a long belt then, because modern guns now run on pans, or they did at the end of the First War run on pans, but in then there was a long belt, this old Maxim gun. Well, he cleaned it, he sighted it up, pushed the muzzle through the sandbags, parted the sandbags, sighted it up, and run right through this belt of ammunition. I don't know how many rounds, 100, perhaps 150 rounds in it. I don't know, never forget. Run the belt right through. Well, later on, blowed if he didn't get a DCM. Well, that's next to a VC, ain't it? Distinguished Conduct Medal. And he didn't know what the hell he got it for, till he was told. Well, what had actually happened? Behind the lines in those days, they used to send up a sort of a, what they call barrage balloon in the last war. But really, they was observation balloons from the artillery. They used to send a balloon up, you know, let it sail up with a observer in it and have a look all around their lines from behind their lines and then come down and report. Well, it happens that this Sunday morning, particular Sunday morning, this barrage balloon was up there. Well, I nearly said his name again. When he loosed off his machine gun, he put the sights on a church behind the German lines, perhaps about some distance behind the German lines. He put the sighted his gun on that, loosed off the ammunition. Well, it appears the Germans then was coming out from a church service, right? And as they come out the church service, this machine gun was trained on it and was fetching them down. So, of course, the AI had a DCM for killing all this lot of Germans or fetching them down. But he didn't see them coming out. He was sighted on the gun and, you know, sort of loosed off, and that was that. But anyway, that's what he got his DCM for. Yeah. Now then, want some more tales? Mm-hmm. Oh, hell, what shall I think of now?
What about Fatty Odle?
Fatty, yeah. Ah, there you are. Now, that's a good tale, that is. How he got a court-martial. Now, you wouldn't credit this. This was early on, mind you. He was allowed to write, because you could write home as much as you like, but you was allowed, I reckon, about one what they call green envelope, one a week. And that green envelope, you could seal that down. All your others you had to leave open so that they could be checked if they wished to check them. But a green envelope was private, not supposed to be checked. And it was for, you know, married men, right secret, you know, personal matters to the wife or something. But Fatty had a green envelope, and he wrote to his girl, Liz Scragg, that was Joe Scragg's sister, they courted, and eventually married, naturally. But he wrote to Liz and told her all where we was at Plug Street, the times, you know, what was happening and so on. And they opened Fatty's envelope, be a bit of luck. And, well, he had a court-martial for talking about the front, telling Liz where we was, you know. And he had a court-martial. How many days he had, I don't know. I can't remember. That's over 60, getting on for 70 years ago, as the saying is. And Fatty had this court-martial so many days. First field punishment. Well, first field punishment, you was tied to the wheel. That was all horse-grown vehicles, a carriage wheel, gun carriage wheel or cookhouse wheel. And every day, for so long, hour or perhaps 2 hours, he was tied to that wheel and had to stay there. Couldn't move, it didn't matter if it was snowing, blowing, raining, anything. He had to have that every day for so many days, just for writing that letter. Now, there's a chap, he's dead now, he used to live over the hill, old Charlie Teagle. Well, Charlie was bugle major in our lot. Old Joe Scragg was a bugler, but he was bugle major, Charlie Teagle. And when we come out in after the war, you know, when we had a drink or anything in the club or a pub, and that was mentioned, old Charlie used to say that. Bloody well made me cry, he said. Tying old Fatty up, you know. And we used to have a laugh about that sort of thing. But that was punishment just because he wrote that. So you can tell the sort of punishment you'd get if you were caught asleep or found behind the lines. Now then, what other tale can I tell you? Oh, shall I tell you how I nearly had one? Mm. Well, that was a near go. I made Lance Corporal. What the hell for, I don't know. Anyway, they made me Lance Corporal. And just behind our line there, we were very close to the Germans there, only about 100 yards apart. Well, 300 or 400 yards behind our line was a farmhouse, a big old farmhouse, and all cellars underneath, and they used to keep a batch of reserves under that, you see, in case they broke through. Christ, they broke through at the front. Well, under all these cellars, there was a mob of ours there, and just behind that farmhouse, there was a cottage, farm labourer's cottage. And there was a cellar under that. Well, now, I was told I'd got to take a section. I had a section, I don't know, 7 or 8, I forget now. And I'd got to take this section in the cellar behind this farmhouse, you see. Well, during the day, hadn't been there a day too, but any road, one day, oh, hell, old Jerry Lustorf, shells splashing here, there and everywhere, and machine gunning, and I heard a hell of a squeal. Well, when they started shelling, naturally, it was my job. I told these chaps, you know, the section, I said, get ready, I said, fix your bayonets, I said, and get ready in case they come. I said, and I'll go up on top and lay at the top of the cellar, because half the places was knocked down. I said, I'll lay up top and watch and see if they break. I said, and if they do, I'll give you a shout. Well, I was shelling, I heard a hell of a squeal at this farm. And I shouted across, I said, who's that? Somebody shouted back, they said, it's your old mate, Sid. That was my old mate, Sid Carroll. Said, it's your old mate, Sid. I said, oh, hell, I never thought for a second. I jumped out that blooming cellar and started to run across to this farm. And then somebody shouted, as fact it was old Arthur Willis. He shouted back, go on back, he said, it's all his or I'll go back. So I turned around and run back. Well, I ran back, got in this cellar. All the shelling stopped, quietened down, nothing happened. No breakthrough, nothing. All died down, quiet again. Because when it's quiet, you can't. There's no firing, no rifle fire, no shelling, it's quiet. Well, at night, when it got dark, a sergeant and a corporal come to this cellar. Sergeant said to me, you're under arrest. I said, what for? He says, never mind. So he turned to this corporal. He says, you take charge of these men. He said, you come with me, you're under arrest. We started to walk across some field, and field way, towards the captain's Captain Birchall's dugout. He was our captain, Birchall. And when we were going, I says, what the hell's up? Blimey, so I wouldn't like to be in your place. I says, why? He says, you know what you're charged with? He says, desertion and cowardice under shell fire. I said, what the hell are you talking about? He said, it's right. He says, you'll see. Well, he took me into old Birchall in his dugout. So he says, you know what you're charged with? I said, no. Desertion, he says, cowardice, shellfire, deserting your men. I says, I didn't. He says, you did. He said, I saw you. He said, I saw you from my own dugout. He said, I saw you run away. I said, I didn't. And do you know? Because I told him what had actually happened, you see. And he understood. He said, well, he said, I won't report you. He said, if I do, he said, you've got no hope whatever. He says, you was in that cellar with a section to lead those men if they attacked. He said, and your job was there to lead them. He says, it don't matter whatever happens, he said. In a battle, he says, you mustn't bother about your friends, he says, not even your brother. He says, if he falls, he said, don't bother, you're in a battle, he said. Stretcher bearers are provided for that. He said, not you, he said, stretcher bearers. He says, and you left those men. They hadn't got a leader. He says, and how you didn't get killed, he said, I don't know. He said, but you ran away and left them. But he said, I won't report you. But he said, don't ever do that again. Always remember. See? But he said, there was just one very, very small thing in your favour that may have helped to save you. He says, when you ran away and left them, He said you were running towards the Germans, not away from them. So that was a bit of luck, wasn't it? That farmhouse was between that cottage and their front line. And that's what happened over that. Now, there was a climax to that. Later on the Somme, he was a very brave man, you know, old Churchill was. I'm not talking about heroes, I don't believe in it. A very brave man, old Jim Butcher was. And later on the Somme...
Just a minute, we'll...
on the Somme, wasn't it? With Captain Birchall on the Somme. Well, I told you what happened to him. I'm sure I did. I think I know where I got to. It was... sort of a climax of what he told me about never bother with your mates or even if it's your brother, didn't I? Well, in the Battle of the Somme, he done some very brave things. At least they told me he did. I wasn't there at the time. And what actually happened, in the attack, Joe Scragg was his servant. See, buglers and those, they went as servants, officers' servants. And he was Birchall's servant. And during the attack, Birchall was brought down. It. Joe stopped with him, picked him up and brought him back, looked after him. And the outcome was, Birchall had the DSO, Joe Scragg had the DCM. Now then, what would have happened if he'd have done what Birchall told me I'd got to do. They got medals for doing something that Birchall said I hadn't ought to have done, didn't he? Now there's a difference in war, but don't tell me that wasn't a brave thing as old Joe done, looking after him and all that sort of thing. But as I said before, there's no such thing as heroes and cowards. They were trained to do it. I was drilled into them to do that sort of thing. Well, what else do you want to know? Because anything else have I said on them other tapes that I haven't thought of?
All I want you to really say is your sort of... Now
then, let me be a bit careful. I should get an hell of a ray, you know, for people won't agree with me. My summing up of it, but I don't care whether they do or not. It's my view, and it's what I think of the war, taking it from beginning to end. That was from the first week of the war, 3 times wounded, 20 months a prisoner of war, so I can speak from experience and give my view of what the war was and why I didn't think there was such a thing as heroes and cowards. Now, if I weighed it all up and I said this, my view of heroes was the millions that lined up outside recruiting offices. That's my view of heroes. The cowards was those that lay dead in no man's land, and the prisoners of war, because I was one of them, and they were no further use to that massive war machine, which was nothing more than a machine. And there was no further use to that. Now, years and years later, when we got old, my old darling and me went to the Albert Hall on the 11th of November, British Legion Remembrance Service. Now, at the end of that service, the lights was dimmed, the poppies slowly fell down from the roof, the buglers sounded the last post, and then a loud, clear voice said, "At the going down of the sun, and in the morning, we will remember them." Now, remember who? I leave you to judge that. That do for you?
Wonderful. Good.
Hey?
Fantastic, yeah. I find that very moving. I mean, I've heard it now several times, and it's a very, very moving story.
True, now, though.
This Greg didn't actually know much about the First World War. I mean,
who?
Greg, our young man across here.
No.
He hasn't, you know, Greg... Have you got any questions you'd like to ask Mr. Mundy at all? Can you think of anything about the war that you'd like to know?
No, not really. From what I've
heard. Do you find it interesting?
Yeah.
How would you feel about it? I mean, he was... Well, yeah. How old do you know? You're...
15.
15, you know, like young Ashley then.
Yeah.
Do you know my nephew, great nephew, Ashley O'Brien? Oh, I don't suppose you know him any.
But about 3 years, you would have been eligible at this time of this war to actually go out and fight in the war.
Yeah.
How would you have felt about it, do you think? Would you enjoy the sort of experience that Mr. Mundy's had, do you think?
Don't really know until you've tried it, do you? Would you enjoy it or not?
Conversation. Do they learn you history at school?
Yes, yeah, but they're not...
No, I'll tell you what I mean.
Support history,
I'll tell you what I mean by history. Do they boost it up like they did when we were kids? Because I left school the day I was 13. I started work day I was 13, but that don't matter.